Welcome to A Hard Look, the Administrative Law Review podcast from the Washington College of Law. We'll discuss how administrative law impacts your daily life, from regulatory actions by agencies and the litigation over them to the balance of power among branches of the government. This is A Hard Look.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Administrative Law Review's A Hard Look. My name is Will Chavez, and I'll be your host today. I am a fourth-year evening student on the Administrative Law Review at American University Washington College of Law. This episode of A Hard Look is the second in a series of four episodes that are examining the role that racism has historically played in administrative law, the ways that racism still actively pervades the administrative law space, and the ways that practitioners, leaders, scholars, and our listeners can effectuate change. The series was inspired by the Yale Journal of Regulations Symposium on Racism in Administrative Law. A special thank you to Professor Catherine Kovacs for spearheading the symposium and for getting this conversation started. I am excited to introduce to you our two guests. First off, we have Dean Jerry L. Anderson, who is the Dean and Richard M. and Anita Calkins Distinguished Professor of Law at Drake University Law School, where he teaches environmental law, administrative law, and property. Dean Anderson is an elected member of the American Law Institute and the American College of Environmental Lawyers. He co-founded Midwest Environmental Justice Advocates, a nonprofit law group that successfully litigated several high-profile environmental cases in Iowa. Over the summer, Dean Anderson authored Devil in the Details: Structural Racism in Administrative Hearings for the Yale Symposium on Racism in Administrative Law. Our next guest is Steph Tai, who is a professor of law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Law School. Professor Tai's scholarly research examines the interactions between environmental and health sciences and administrative law. They were an adjunct law professor at Georgetown from 2002 through 2005, and a visiting professor at Washington and Lee University School of Law during the 2005 through 2006 academic year. They have also clerked on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, worked as an appellate attorney in the Environmental and Natural Resources Division of the U.S. Department of Justice, and served as a U.S. Supreme Court Fellow as a researcher in the Federal Judicial Center. Over the summer, Professor Tai authored Racism and Informal Agency Adjudicatory Decisions, or Is Racism Arbitrary and Capricious, for the Yale Symposium on Racism in Administrative Law. Dean Anderson and Professor Tai, thank you very much for joining us today. As our listeners just heard, there is a lot of environmental advocacy between the two of you. How did each of you get involved in environmental and administrative law? Dean Anderson?
Well, it actually goes back to middle school when I started my own environmental club, which was actually around the time of the first Earth Day, so that tells you how old I am. But in law, I started working for a law firm and did environmental cases on the corporate side. And then when I became a professor, I had more freedom to choose which cases I wanted to work on, and we discovered that the public interest side was really underrepresented, as it is in most states. But in Iowa, we started a public interest law firm called Midwest Environmental Justice Advocates, and we started taking impact litigation cases. And so we worked on cases from water pollution to noise pollution to preservation of one of the last sand prairie remnants in Iowa. And it was really a great experience because in addition to trying to do some good in the world, we learned a lot about how administrative law really works in the real world and some of the issues with that mechanism.
Awesome. And Professor Tai, the same question.
I actually took a roundabout way to get into environmental law. That is, I started off actually as a chemist and following in the footsteps of my parents. And as an undergrad, I somehow lucked into a research opportunity with Professor Mario Molina, who eventually won the Nobel Prize, or co-won the Nobel Prize for discovering the ozone hole and the process of ozone depletion. And he really turned me around in thinking about ways that human activities can impact the environment, even in ways that we don't anticipate. And so I ended up going to grad school, studying atmospheric chemistry. And there I happened to take some policy classes and realized, you know, people don't actually listen to scientists that much. So I decided to go for even more schooling and went to law school as a result. And I'm fortunate to be able to work in this area and to eventually represent my old college professor in cases before the Supreme Court. Unfortunately, he passed away this year, and I miss him sorely.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. Well, thank you so much again for joining us today. And so today, we are discussing administrative hearings, adjudication, and other ways of public participation in administrative law. Can you please explain what are these systems and how do people engage with them?
Yeah, so the Federal Administrative Procedure Act sets forth processes by which that all federal agencies have to follow. And those processes not only restrict agencies from doing things willy-nilly, but also create systems for judicial review. That is, systems whereby courts can evaluate what agencies are doing. Now, what the Administrative Procedure Act, or the APA, does is it creates almost different kind of categories. That is, categories for formal adjudications, formal rulemaking, which isn't used very much, informal rulemaking, and then this catch-all category for informal adjudications. And this is, you know, basically created by the structure of the Administrative Procedure Act. And for all of these, there's different categories for how courts can review those different types of actions. And so the types of things that I and Professor Anderson will be talking about today involve different categories of this. That is, adjudications, both formal and then also informal. And so these can range from things that look a little bit like mini court hearings to things that just look like, just sort of more one-off decisions, like decisions to give a grant or not give a grant, decisions to give a loan or not give a loan.
All of this is primarily done in the federal level with the agencies. How about states? Is the process similar, Dean Anderson?
Yes and no. Studying the state level is really important, I think, because so much of environmental law and a lot of other areas as well, even if you're under a federal statute, it's the enforcement and implementation of it has often been delegated to the state agency. So if you are talking about getting a Clean Water Act permit, for example, or being penalized for violating your Clean Water Act permit, then you're typically going to be before a state administrative agency and you're going to be following state administrative law. So states typically have their own versions of the Administrative Procedure Act. And they provide for administrative hearings, but there's going to be more variation among the states as exactly how those work. They use the term contested case to refer to a trial-type hearing, and the state law will specify how those are going to be conducted. So if you are denied a Clean Water Act permit, for example, and you don't like how the permit was written, the regulated entity has the right to seek a contested case hearing, and then you can appeal that. And that's the other difference in state law, is that the appeal will go to the some sort of citizen commission at the top of the state agency. So in Iowa, for example, we have the Environmental Protection Commission, which is appointed by the governor. And so that citizen commission will have the final say on whether a permit will be granted or whether a fine is going to be levied against a violator. So it's important to look at the state statutes regarding who is on those agency commissions and how that process would work.
Thank you very much. That's fascinating. You know, it's not often taught, I think, in administrative law and law school to also look at the state administrative processes. So I know that for myself, that's the first time I'm, you know, kind of hearing and digesting information focused on the state process. So thank you for bringing that to us today. Dean Anderson, in your article on Yale's Notice and Comment blog, you address some of the ways that racism is inherent in these processes. How do you see racism come into administrative hearings?
Yes, you know, in my field of environmental law, we talk about environmental justice, and it's something that we've recognized, you know, back in the 1970s, we started to pay attention to the fact that environmental harms are disproportionately borne by people of color. And so here we are almost 50 years later, and we've had some activity in that area. Bill Clinton, for example, had an executive order to ask agencies to pay attention to environmental justice. EPA created an Office of Environmental Justice. But here we are all these years later, and it's still a big problem. And so my idea is that, you know, it's not typically the result of overt racism, although of course that still is occurs. But what I look at more is the inherent racism in the system itself. And it shouldn't be a surprise that people in power try to create mechanisms that preserve that power. But it takes a lot of work to find out exactly where the mechanism is breaking down. And hearings, administrative hearings, are one of those areas because they are designed to provide access and due process rights, but typically only for the regulated entity, or as you might say, the polluter. And they do not provide the same kinds of access and due process rights for the people that are going to be most impacted by the pollution. So, for example, the polluter has the right to a contested case hearing, and they can put on expert witnesses and cross-examine the agency's witnesses and build a very effective case at the agency level for being allowed to pollute, whereas the citizens who are going to be affected have much more limited ability to affect that process. They have to submit written comments, which and they can't do cross-examination, they can't build their cases effectively, and then they have to appeal to a court, and the court will review that decision based on a very lenient, arbitrary and capricious standard typically, and it will be based on the record below, which was one-sided to begin with. And so that's just an example of how the deck is really stacked against those who would object to pollution from a citizen level, and often those are people of color in the communities that are most affected.
Professor Tai, what about agency actions that don't fall under administrative hearings? Do you have any examples?
Yeah, in my Yale symposium paper, I give a number of examples of what's called informal adjudications. That is, these wide range of sort of one-off decisions that agencies make that don't fall under the categories that Dean Anderson talked about. So one example is for sort of National Institute of Health funding. So these are just decisions to give grants to particular researchers and not give grants to particular researchers based on applications. Another example is sort of giving loans to various farmers for maintaining their farms, maintaining their equipment, etc. And another example is FEMA's, the Federal Emergency Management Agency's, voluntary flood buyout programs. All of these are not, you know, formal hearings or even informal hearings. There's no hearing process related to it. People just submit their application packages, but these are government decisions and they fall under informal adjudications and thus also have this sort of arbitrary and capricious kind of standard that apply to them. Yet all of these examples that I give in my paper are ones where there's strong racial disparities that have been found. In some of them, the disparities were most likely due to implicit bias. But for example, in the USDA decisions, and it was recognized in the settlement before the USDA and the various farmers raising class action claims, for the USDA decisions, this was actually just straight up racism. So these are all different areas where racism or implicit bias can exist in just these kinds of funding decisions that come from agencies.
Dean Anderson, when we talk about environmental justice, I wanted to explore that area a little bit more. We have this concept of barriers to public participation that you brought up and that Professor Tai has also brought up in their last comment. The question is, who makes these decisions and how easy is it to actually participate?
Yeah, that's a great question because it really is important, I think, to look at who is making these decisions. We pay a lot of attention to that in other areas of the law, but it really is neglected in this area, I think. And so primarily we're talking about two types of bodies, I think. A lot of the locally unwanted land uses or LULUs, things that people don't want in their backyard, a lot of times those are zoning decisions. And the local zoning boards are typically going to be weighted towards those that are white-collar workers and developer-oriented occupations. And so we did a study back some years ago that's published in the Urban Lawyer, where we did a survey of the zoning boards in large cities in the United States. And we found that they are heavily oriented towards white-collar workers and those with some ties to developers. So you're not getting the perspective of those who are affected by these unwanted land uses as much on those zoning boards. And we also found that people of color are significantly unrepresented as well. So about 84% of zoning board members in those major cities were white or non-Hispanic, and that, of course, woefully underrepresents the people of color. And so, you know, if you go back to the 1970s, the person who's called the father of environmental justice, Dr. Robert Bullard, identified this as a problem in Houston, where almost all of the landfills and waste incinerators were located in black neighborhoods, even though at the time people of color represented only 25% of the city's population. And if you looked at the city council at the time, it was overwhelmingly made up of white people. And so I think that is significant, that we have to get those boards to more closely represent the people of the city, and primarily we have to work on getting representation for people that are affected by the zoning decisions and people of color. The other place where that matters is at the state boards that I represented, that I talked about earlier, where you have the State Environmental Commission, for example. And if you look at those, you'll find the same thing, that they are overwhelmingly going to be made up of white people and typically not the people that are affected most by pollution. And so you'll find statutes, for example, that require certain occupations to be represented on those commissions, like, you know, you have to have an industry representative, you have to have somebody from agriculture, but there are no statutes that I'm aware of that require representation for people of color or for those that are most affected by the pollution. And so, again, you know, we have to look at trying to make sure that this is a fair system. And to do that, I think we need to look more closely at the representation of those who are making the decision.
Professor Tai, I was wondering if you would be able to give our listeners some more detail on the USDA example that you brought up when you were discussing informal adjudication.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just wanted to contrast the different agencies that I talk about. Like in some agencies, the problem is the same as that that Dean Anderson mentioned. That is that the people who are the decision makers for grant funding and stuff are often just mostly white, mostly, you know, coming from elite classes and stuff. But with the USDA, there was an additional layer on top of that where the folks that were making the loan decisions for farmers to basically be able to maintain their farms often were delegated from the federal side into different sort of state and local kind of decision makers, many of whom actually had vested interest in getting the black farmers out of farming. That is, they had friends or they themselves wanted to be able to buy up the lands. And so in that example, there was, you know, just rife sort of racism that was going on there because of this whole system of delegating the decision-making power to people with actual conflicts of interest.
Thank you. I think that the New York Times 1619 project briefly did a segment on this situation with a farmer. So it's not the first time that I've heard about it, but this is definitely another concrete example of racism and how that plays into the administrative law field. So now that we've discussed these instances and real concrete examples of how racism is seen and how it's felt in daily lives, I guess that the next question is, are there solutions, or how do we dismantle a system that seems to be pretty one-sided towards, you know, bigger interests and not people of color? We could start with Professor Tai. Do you have any ideas for solutions by any chance?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's difficult, partly because we, as a society, have not really put much willpower into this. To the extent that we have, we can look to different experiments that have been tried by particular agencies. For example, the NIH, when they first realized this disparity between funding of Black researchers versus funding of white researchers, they actually went through and they did both internal trainings. They also tried to sort of hire a lot more folks from minority communities. And then they also tried to sort of reform their grant review process so that certain kinds of biases would be less able to come out in the grant review process. Now, it's partly this is just, you know, sort of minor experimentation, but, you know, they keep going through to try to figure out whether or not these kinds of reforms are working. And I think that that's one thing that's necessary, is to sort of experiment with different types of reforms to actually track whether they're working. And one thing Biden promised during his campaign was to do something similar, actually, for the USDA. That is, in his platform, he talked about forming a USDA equity commission that would focus on sort of jurisdictional and regulatory barriers that Black, Brown, and Native farmers and ranchers, et cetera, face, and they would actually direct that that equity commission to review all of the various programs, like the loan programs, but also other types of support programs, to sort of design a plan to sort of address racism or even implicit bias within the system. Now, again, we don't know whether or not, one, any of this will come to fruition, and two, whether or not these efforts are sufficient to address racism. But I think this is a start, just to actually start trying different methods and expressly sort of commit to tracking the progress of those methods.
And thank you. And Dean Anderson, and also Professor Tai, you both have extensive environmental litigation experience. And I'm wondering if you can also maybe mention how litigation is being used to maybe level the playing field a little bit when it comes to, you know, racist consequences and consequences of these systems. Dean Anderson, would you want to say something about that?
Yes, definitely. And I think that goes back to your question about possible solutions, because, you know, I think when you're talking about the things that I was mentioning about where are you going to put the power plant, where are you going to put the landfill, how are you going to fight a pollution permit, for example, for a factory in your neighborhood. Those are things that typically are going to have to be litigated. And if we put up barriers to that public participation in that process, it makes it that much harder for low-income communities in particular to be able to have an equal say in where those landfills are going to go or where the power plant's going to go. And so I think we have to look very carefully about what barriers are being put up to participation by those communities. So just to give you an example, you know, one of the examples is what I talked about earlier, is restrictions on contested cases. Because if you can participate fully at the agency level, that's typically going to be a lot cheaper and a lot easier than having to file a court case later on and try to challenge that in the district court. And so if we can eliminate that barrier, for example, that would help. But even down to the level of the topic of this podcast, which is administrative hearings, a lot of times those are designed in a way that makes it really hard for people to make their voices heard. And it's basically a collective action problem where you've got a low-income community, maybe a community of color, that is against a particular power plant or factory locating in their neighborhood. But in order for them to get the resources that they're going to need to hire an expert witness, to hire lawyers to fight that, it's going to be very difficult for them to organize effectively. So you have these hearings that the statute requires that might be an opportunity for them to come together and organize and, you know, let other people know, the media know, the public know, about their objections to a particular project. But the way the hearing is typically organized, it is organized in a way that basically disperses that that public opposition, prevents organizing, prevents people from hearing each other and communicating with each other, and prevents them from organizing. So they organize it basically in a lot of cases like you would organize a high school science fair, where you've got poster boards where people can walk around and look at the project and hear from the people that are promoting the project, and then write down their objections or their comments at the end of the exhibition. That's not really what we want to see as a hearing, because people can't communicate with each other. They can't find out what other people are objecting to and say, yeah, you know, that is bad, and I agree with that, and build opposition to a particular project. And so, again, that's just one example of barriers that we put up to collective action that make it hard for people to mount effective opposition to things that are going to affect their communities, and often those are low-income communities or communities and or communities of color.
And I wonder, in the corona, because of the coronavirus, because of social distancing and the safety precautions that the CDC has suggested and many states have implemented, I wonder if the process that you've just described, Dean Anderson, takes into account the fact that people don't want to be congregating in indoor spaces with a lot of people and shouldn't be because of COVID-19. Dean Anderson, do you know if those processes are continuing throughout the pandemic?
No, I don't. I don't know anything about that. So, I mean, I'm guessing certainly that it will be harder, even more difficult to organize and collectively oppose a project, but I really don't know, you know, the extent to which that's going on.
Can I jump in?
Please go ahead.
My sense is there's actually a great variety among jurisdictions. Like some localities are still holding in-person meetings for comments on things, and then some places are moving more towards some kind of Zoom participatory effort. So I think that, you know, if anything, the pandemic is making things a lot less homogeneous, just because there's so much discretion with different local decision makers to deal with stuff in this quote-unquote state of emergency. I also wanted to expand a little bit upon what Dean Anderson was saying. One, yes, these are horrible barriers, and I think this really hurts environmental justice efforts. And there's other things, too, that makes it really difficult to sort of use litigation as a tool to advance environmental justice. That is, the Supreme Court in Alexander versus Sandoval in 2001 said that private suits under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act that prohibits discrimination on the basis of color, race, etc., based on programs that receive federal funds, they said that this doesn't apply for disparate impacts. It only applies for if one can bring a showing of intentional discrimination. And as Dean Anderson mentions, that's a very high hurdle. It's a very difficult hurdle to meet. That said, I actually worked with a friend of mine who's an environmental justice community organizer in Detroit, talking about ways that lawyers can use litigation, but not as the traditional litigation tool. That is, one can use litigation in what my friend calls a scaffolding approach, and this is also a term used in community justice organizing, where you use things like litigation to actually scaffold the grassroots efforts. That is, bringing litigation so that there are points to rally around and focusing the litigation not necessarily on winning the pieces of litigation, but using them to advance sort of more political kind of efforts. And that might be a sort of answer to your question about positive ways that litigation can be used to sort of advance racial justice.
Thank you. Excellent. We were discussing solutions or, you know, where we go from here. And I wonder if Professor Tai, if you might have any other ideas or suggestions, or Dean Anderson, you know, we thank you for your time, and I think that this would be the final point here. Or if you both have anything else you'd want to mention on the podcast, we would welcome that.
Okay. So, I mean, I think that having things like the Equity Commission and seeing how well that works, I think that's a start. You know, having agencies sort of having a focus for agencies to review themselves and to sort of assess whether or not they're acting in equitable ways is important. However, that can't be the end part of it, right? You have, for example, the EPA Inspector General saying that, you know, over many, many years, saying that the EPA's environmental justice efforts have been actually pretty inadequate. And so I think that having internal review commissions, while potentially a start, isn't really sufficient unless there's some kind of teeth to it. Now, what would that teeth be? It might be something like much more visible reporting before Congress or something, and that would sort of raise it up somewhat. It might be that one can file internal complaints, right, for sort of inequitable kind of outcomes. That is a way to challenge within the agency some kind of overall systemic racism versus having to sort of deal with whether or not an individual decision is arbitrary and capricious. So these might be ways to get started, at least trying to tackle systemic racism within agencies.
Dean Anderson, we've come to the end of the podcast here. Are there any other thoughts that you'd want to share?
I mentioned before that there's been some recognition of environmental justice at the federal level, and with President Clinton's executive order and the establishment of EPA's Office of Environmental Justice. But I think the discussion today certainly illustrates that there needs to be more recognition of this problem at the state level and the local level, because that's where the rubber meets the road on a lot of these decisions. And I really don't think that there's been as much recognition or activity at those levels. And so that can start with, you know, for example, making sure that there is equal representation on zoning boards, on environmental commissions at the state level. And it can also involve, you know, some harder work in going through the Administrative Procedure Act to try to reduce the barriers for people to participate. And so, you know, it's work that really needs to be done. If you look at the pandemic, it has disproportionately impacted people of color. And that is probably not surprising and is tied to our discussion today, because if you have communities that are more impacted, for example, by air pollution and by particulate matter, for example, they have higher rates of asthma, they have higher rates of heart issues and other cardiovascular problems. And so they are going to have those pre-existing conditions that are going to make the pandemic worse for them. And so it really goes back to what we've been talking about today, that we have put the environmental harms disproportionately on communities of color, and that is now coming to roost even more with the pandemic, and deserves more recognition and more work to try to ameliorate it.
Thank you both so much for joining me today. Once again, this episode of A Hard Look is the second in a series of four episodes that are examining the role of racism in administrative law. You can find the rest of the episodes of the series wherever you get your podcast and at administrativelawreview.org. Thank you again to Professor Catherine Kovacs and the Yale Journal of Regulation for their symposium. We would also like to extend a thank you to the ABA Administrative Law Section, ALR's Executive Board and staffers, Sharon Wolf, Professor Jill Olmsted, and Professor Andy Popper. Lastly, thank you to Shabir Hamid for editing this episode. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the ALR website, and wherever you get your podcasts. We would greatly appreciate it if you could like, rate, and subscribe. If you would like to be a guest on an episode or have any questions or comments, please email them to sarah@alr-sr-tech-editor@wcl.american.edu. The email will also be in the episode notes, along with any links referenced in this episode and the bios for our guests. Thank you for listening. I am your host, Will Chavez, and this has been A Hard Look.